know they can come and they get the report.
What could be the result?
Honorable Father, no. Nobody is telling you that you come late. You took the decision.
No.
Yes, you took the decision.
No, I know.
I'm saying you took the decision as we let us not argue about that one, because you have got honorable members around you. Then you should be amazed why honorable members are not saying the same thing that you are saying. Because here they are puzzled. They are puzzled that they are using your
opinion and understand. There's something that you just took, you said, when you are addressing me. And you alluded to me having raised the issue of this witness and passing. You said, oh, go to the answer if you want, you can go back to the record and check. I raised this matter and you are saying it's not a new matter. It's a quality now potential that without all the witnesses having gone through this process,
there is
no
way
you can arrive at this
answer. Yes. Yes, honorable boy.
Honorable Twan, I have a 6 o'clock, and 6 o'clock will close the finishing of the meeting. You are not here. And I don't know what he is discussing. You are not there when we were discussing in the year of who I was invited as witnesses. It's a problem of the year that it can't be our problem. I mean, we have agreed that we will proceed to the honorable Commissioner is the most correct person. He is witness on what the issue is. Honorable Commissioner has not been part of any meeting. That's why now and to get us to go to a court. He was not part of the process.
Yes. Honorable members, we need to come to the end of this specific discussion, which is very unfortunate, because it is your own internal thing that you have taken decisions and you undermine your own decision, and then you should go and do it the right at the best. But today, because honorable members, we came for the report, you must allow the initiator to table the report. When he has finished with that, you can give yourself as much time as you like to discuss all your internal problems and confusions that may arise. Honorable members, I think we are moving forward. I now need to recognize Lester Van Kore to take us forward. Honorable Twan, please.
So can you allow us, Honorable Chair, to put our position on record?
Honorable Twan, we came here to receive the report from the initiative. As agreed that we.
No, there is no need
for us to actually have some other gymnastics about this.
Allow me, Chair, to say my piece, then you can proceed and keep.
No, I've said to yourself, Honorable Twan, that if you have got anything to say, whether in terms of procedure, in terms of internal arrangements, your own logistics, then that discussion belongs to us.
No, sir, it belongs in this committee. We need to put something on record in this committee, and then you can proceed. Allow us to do so.
Honorable Twan, you're really trying to make the job that I have to do today to be more difficult.
No,
I really do not understand why you have a problem. If you've got anything to raise in terms of procedure and arrangement, today here we are in a hearing. We are not in the committee. Then your committee session belongs outside, where you actually have to convince each other on anything that you want to raise. Irrespective of whatever you want to raise, you raise it fully, but here it is misplaced, it will be misplaced, and therefore I really plead with you and request you that you reserve whatever you want to say, and just make sure that when Mr. Van Kore is done with the work that he came here for today, and which will
committee members will have sat through all of the and will have viewed all of the video footage will have seen that the facts are important, yes, and there are conclusions that those facts urge, and I will get to those conclusions shortly, but many of the facts are rather straightforward. There are a number of themes that I wish to address in making the presentation, but one of the themes that I think important, and I will deal with this more fully later, the committee will also do well in considering the conduct of the affected honourable members to be guided by its own rules or the House's rules of debate and the guide to procedure dealt with extensively by Mr. Tarso. The committee would also do well to search other parts of comparable jurisdictions for some guidance. I'm going to defer to the rules of debate in the House of Commons of New South Wales. Those rules and their guidelines include the following. Courtesy and self-discipline are vital ingredients of parliamentary discourse. It is no more than elementary good manners for those who have finished speaking to sit through the next speech. It is only through such standards of behaviour as enshrined in the conventions of the House that the traditions of robust debate in a democratic assembly are accepted and upheld. Mr. Chairman, to the extent that it might be thought that robust debate and courtesy self-discipline, robust debate on the one hand, courtesy self-discipline on the other hand, are irreconcilable, I would urge your committee to dispel those notions from their minds. There is nothing more destructive of robust debate than the inability to hear other people, than the forceful carrying on with one's view, notwithstanding attempts by the House and members of the House to restore order.
Um,
government evidence.
If you can just clarify that, because it sounds like a prosecutor. This person is in line. Instead of just saying this is what has transpired here. Is he a prosecutor or is he an evidence leader? Thank you, sir.
I think we all agree that you are going to give us the closing argument on the evidence there in this particular case. Closing argument. And the main argument. And they don't remain just within a textbook of his law or any other book where it just is from page one to the last page. He is actually arguing whether the evidence there in front of us proves the charges or not. And therefore, if you want to limit the initiator arguing that those charges have been proved or not proved, then I don't know why you call it. And therefore, that can't be correct. And every time when as members some sort of confusion, then we must reserve the confusion to ourselves, not to everybody else in the public. Can I proceed with the initiative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I set out that particular part of the limited debate from New South Wales, the conclusion is ultimately that of you and the members of your committee. I raised it in the context of, and Mr. Kultani is in some respects in the context of the evidence given by Mr. Carson. It was Mr. Carson who sat for many, many hours explaining why it was that he thought that there was a breach of the rules of the Assembly in some fundamental respects. That is the factual basis in which I raise that. And I will get to Mr. Carson's evidence in due course. Having set out that bit of the framework, it is now important for me just to return to some other housekeeping aspects, I suppose, of the report. The committee has heard the evidence of Mr. Carson, the Secretary to the National Assembly, Mr. R. Kulia, the Head of Parliament Information, Communication and Technology Services Division, Ms. R. Mushlomi, the Sergeant at Arms. The committee has also then heard the evidence of the Honourable Deputy Chief Whip of the Majority Party, Ms. D. Kakude, and the Honourable Chief Whip of the Opposition, Mr. John Skinhason. The committee has heard the evidence of those five witnesses so far, and they gave their evidence at length. In the giving of that evidence, the members of the committee had a full opportunity to engage with the various witnesses. The members of the committee, in fact, used that opportunity. I recall certainly that at the end of each of the sessions of the committee's engagement with the various witnesses, the chairman was mindful to repeatedly ask members whether they felt, the members of the committee that is, whether they felt that they had a full opportunity to engage and whether they had in fact exhausted the areas that they wished to clarify and explore with the witness. That took place in relation to all of the witnesses who has given evidence so far. Each and every one of the committee members had an opportunity to engage with those witnesses again. Some used that opportunity to a greater extent and maybe more enthusiastically than others. There was a full engagement with the witnesses by all members of the committee, including Mr. Twala,
simultaneously the various affected members confirmed individually that they had received the charges, that they had read the charges, that they knew and understood the charges, and that they had no objection to the manner in which the charges had been put to them. On the day on which that happened, it was the 7th of October, the Honourable Mansami was not present. Subsequently, however, it was brought to the attention of the committee that Ms. Mansami was apparently unwell on the day, and that was the reason for her absence. There was a medical certificate, what might be called a sick note in colloquial speak, apparently issued by a medical practitioner in Malawi. I think the medical practitioner was placed in Blantyre, and the note, as I recall, said that he had given the Honourable Mansami the day off due to ill health. The Honourable Mansami then subsequently informed the committee through you, Mr. Chairman, that she aligned herself with the position taken by other honourable members of the EFF, who, after having confirmed receipt and reading and understanding the charges against them and confirming that they have no objection to the charges, elected not to participate. It was on that basis that the work of the committee then proceeded. What I propose to do is to take the evidence out of order, in other words, not in the chronological order in which that evidence was led. The first witness was Mr. Carson, and he was followed by the other witnesses. I propose to, in broad strokes and in no more than highlight over you, summarize or deal with the evidence of the other witnesses first, and then to turn to the evidence of Mr. Carson. I think it's useful to do so because whilst the evidence of Mr. Carso dealt very specifically and directly and in detailed manner with the various allegations or charges of contempt faced by the honourable members, the evidence of the other witnesses did not necessarily go to those detailed areas, but the committee, and properly so, thought it important that they come before this forum to clarify certain aspects which the committee wanted clarified. One of those witnesses was Mr. Ravi Padilla, the head of Parliament's ICT, Information Communication and Technology Division. Mr. Chairman and the members of your committee, it was suggested that maybe Parliament's IT systems and the various pieces of technology as installed in the chamber of the National Assembly and used on 21 August 2014 were not functioning properly. It was suggested, and I put it no higher than that, that it might be that because that those systems were not functioning properly, that could have contributed to, that might have been a trigger to the subsequent events which unfolded in the House during the session 21 August 2014, being questions for oral reply. This suggestion, I suppose, has its beginnings in that part of the Hansard, and we dealt with this at some length, where I think it was the Honourable Mwango who suggested that his equipment was not working. This, no doubt, created some laughs, and the Speaker invited the Honourable Mwango not to go into exactly what he was referring to by way of his equipment not working. What serves now before this committee by way of evidence in relation to Parliament's, or rather the IT infrastructure and systems in the National Assembly, is the rather detailed evidence of Mr. Ravi Padilla. Mr. Padilla explained that Parliament has a rather detailed standard operating procedure. I handed that up as Bundle D, and Mr. Ravi Padilla explained exactly how the regimes of testings work. Those are largely two regimes. The one regime is the Monday testing, and the other regime is the pre-sitting testing. The pre-sitting testing says Mr. Belia, is carried out between roughly 1,000 hours and 1,200 hours and in anticipation of a session. The Monday testing, says Mr. Belia, is more detailed. Those testing regimes result in a report being produced. I referred the committee, or Mr. Belia has referred the committee, to various reports following the testing, and those reports relate to 19, 20, 21 and 26 August 2014. There was a query by one or more indeed members of the committee to the effect that these documents by way of the reports, and they are at the bundle from pages 117 onwards, that is bundle B, that those documents might not be certified or original copies, and that Mr. Pulia has no first-hand knowledge. I would urge that those documents are what they are. There is no reason whatsoever to disregard them. Those documents are the result of the testing as conducted under Parliament's ordinary standard operating procedures. Yet further, and if this would give the committee members the necessary comfort, those documents in original are available upon the request from the office of Mr. Pulia. Mr. Pulia made his evidence in a clear, coherent, and logical manner. He cooperated with the committee fully in all respects and in relation to all of the issues that have been put to him. Mr. Pulia made it clear that on 21 August, a pre-sitting testing was also carried out, and that testing would have involved the testing of all of the systems, including the request to talk button. Mr. Chairman and the members of your committee, Mr. Belia described, you will recall how the system is tested, 20 buttons at a time, then another 20. An engineer seated at the speaker's chair and at the table staff chair, and another engineer going from desk to desk to ensure that all the systems are tested. And there are reports produced to that effect. Mr. Belia also gave evidence that from time to time it might well be that a request to talk button does get stuck, but the outcome of their testing was that there was no malfunctioning of the systems on the day. There is no reason, I would urge, for you and the members of your committee to disbelieve that evidence. Mr. Belia struck me as a rather straightforward ICT manager. Attention to detail, running a ship involving roughly 65 team members and with the assistance of a contractor on site who also guides and supervises the work that is done by the members of Mr. Pulia's ICT team. I have in the report and by way of assessment of Mr. Pulia's evidence dealt with it in summary form also, and you will find that, Mr. Chairman, the members of your committee, at paragraphs 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, and 49. In short, to the extent that members have some concerns as to systemic malfunctioning of the IT infrastructure and equipment in the chamber on the day, the evidence that serves before you and your committee now ought to put paid to any of that. There can be no suggestion of systemic malfunctioning. There can be no suggestion that the systems weren't working, and there certainly cannot be any suggestion that because it might be thought that the systems were not working, this was a contributory factor to the conduct of some members in the House. I will return to this in a bit more detail later, but by way of anticipating that, it was never, certainly not in the hands of, and certainly not in the video footage viewed by you and the members of your committee, the suggestion of effective honourable members of the EFF, either through the person of Mr. Mayama, Mr. Shivangu, or any other of their number, that their equipment was not working. The members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, will recall that during the supplementary session, a queue rather than being given an opportunity to raise a supplementary question. The Speaker of the National Assembly at that point and for the second time explained the system of supplementary questions. The issue was resolved. Mr. Malema raised his query, the Speaker gave the answer, and Mr. Malema took it no further. There are no facts before this committee that would indicate that it was the contention of Mr. Malema, Mr. Shivambu, or any of the affected honourable members that their equipment at their members' desks was not working and that this might have contributed to a level of frustration. Such evidence is not before you. The evidence of Mr. Pelia is rather straightforward. Insofar as cameras in the National Assembly are concerned, it was suggested, and I put it no higher than being suggested, that it may be or might be the case that the cameras were operated in such a manner so that the committee does not have an holistic view as to what transpires in the chamber of the National Assembly on the day, and indeed the corridors in and around the immediate vicinity of the chamber. Again, in the facts that serve before this committee, Mr. Chairman, and the members of your committee, there is simply no basis to impute any practice out of the ordinary in the way that the cameras were operated, any malice, any attempt to show certain people up relative to others. Mr. Pelia's evidence is not respectful. There are five cameras fixed, as I understood him, in the chamber of the National Assembly. Those cameras are operated remotely by a member or members of his team. On the day in question, those members did not have any extraordinary different mandate, I suppose, to do their work. They did their work as they would have done it on every other day when there was a sitting in the chamber of the National Assembly. On that basis, and to the extent that it was suggested that there is evidence on footage or video footage evidence somewhere, that might give a different slant, a different picture, a fuller picture, I suppose, and the word used was holistic. To the extent that that is the suggestion, I would urge there is simply no basis in the facts for that suggestion. The camera persons did their work in the ordinary way. The engineers in the Hansard Bay did their work in the ordinary way. Mr. Pelia was rather frank about that. I would submit respectfully, Mr. Chairman and a member of your committee, that the committee has every proper basis to accept in full the evidence of Mr. Pelia as to the functioning of the ICT and indeed the IT infrastructure as installed in the chamber of the National Assembly and the fact that it was working on the day. Even if it might be thought that a request to talk unit did not function properly, the issue is that relevant and material insofar as the charges faced by the honourable members is concerned? As I've already alluded to, the affected honourable members themselves make no such claim whatsoever. I would urge that it cannot be said that any suggestion as to malfunctioning was a contributory factor, let alone a trigger to the conduct of certain honourable members on the day, which led to them facing charges of contempt before this committee. The next person who gave evidence was the Sergeant at Arms, Ms. R. Mushlomi. As I recall, the committee was primarily concerned with establishing from Ms. Mushlomi what was the nature, I suppose, and content of her interaction with certain seem too eager. And then the speaker then said, "Sergeant at Arms, please assist me in relieving the members who are not serious." The Sergeant at Arms, as Ms. Rushkovi made clear, regarded that as an instruction, rose from her bench, made her way on the path as described by her, past the benches of the majority party, coming through the middle, I think passing at some point eventually the seat of the Honourable Prince Buzadevi. But before doing so, she stopped at the place where the Honourable Mr. Ngozi was standing. And there, the Sergeant at Arms, the evidence was quite clear. She attempted to engage with Mr. Ngozi. It was not a conversation because Mr. Ngozi was ignoring her. Mr. Ngozi was, by that time, was on his feet, gesticulating, saying various things, speaking to the speaker directly. Having gotten no relief or joy or a ready ear from Mr. Ngozi, the Sergeant at Arms said she then proceeded to the place where the leader of the EFF was standing, and standing next to him was the Honourable Shivambu. She pleaded with him, I use her word. The speaker has spoken. Please do not make my job more difficult than it is. You are ordered to leave the house. If the Sergeant at Arms said that she spoke to Mr. Malema in her mother tongue, Sipeni. Mr. Malema made it absolutely clear that the honourable members were not going anywhere. Mr. Chairman and the members of your committee, the Sergeant at Arms then said, well, or with the effect that she would then have to call security to remove them if they would not cooperate. And in that inimitable phrase, the Sergeant at Arms tells us, Mr. Malema, the Honourable Malema responded, Babiche, Babiche. I hope I will not do too much violence to the Sergeant at Arms' mother tongue. Babiche, Babiche, in other words, call them, call them. This was consistent with the views expressed or the statement made by the Honourable Shivambu on an earlier occasion and some minutes before, where we see Mr. The Honourable Shivambu say on the radio from Beach, we are not going anywhere. The Honourable, or rather the Sergeant at Arms, said that this is the first occasion on which a person who was asked to leave the house immediately or withdraw from the house immediately did not do so upon the speaker's instruction, and on another occasion when the speaker called on her assistance of the Sergeant at Arms, and while she was still making her way in the general direction of the affected member left. And so, Mr. Chairman, you and the members of your committee now know what the Sergeant at Arms said to Mr. Ngozi, what the Sergeant at Arms said to the Honourable Malema and Shivambu, and what the Honourable Malema said to the Sergeant at Arms. There can be little doubt, and I will return to it under the appropriate charge shortly, that the affected honourable members who faced the charge of not leaving the chamber when instructed to withdraw immediately knew what they were required to do, and deliberately and intentionally refused to comply with the speaker's instruction. Ms. Mishlomi also, in rather straightforward and matter-of-fact terms, said that she was not involved in any discussions or interactions which involved calling members of the SAPS into the chamber. I deal with these aspects in the submissions at paragraphs 52.8 up to and including 52.8.5. Ms. Mishlomi made it clear that she certainly did not call upon the SAPS to enter the chamber. There was a discussion, as I recall, between Ms. Mishlomi as the Sergeant at Arms, and I think it was the Honourable Mwango who asked the Sergeant at Arms whether 2 minutes, and I think it was 38 seconds, there is a reference in the report for her to persuade the other two members, a gentleman and a lady, as described by the Sergeant at Arms, to leave the chamber at that point. The Sergeant at Arms said that those two persons were members of the majority party, but that she could not recall their names.
Gracias.
organizing the corridors in the immediate vicinity of the chamber of the National Assembly. Mr. Kakude also testified that, and it was certainly her sense, that the members were upset. Mr. Kakude testified that those who attended the meeting, chief whips and whips, were, as she said, speaking with one voice. The turn of phrase of Ms. Kakude was that the members of the EFF who were remaining in the House, refusing to leave the chamber, could not access to hold the House to ransom, and that the agreement was in the chief whip's boardroom D16 that the chief whips would have their members removed from the vicinity of the National Assembly so that the necessary steps could be taken for the members of the EFF to be removed. They then left that venue and when coming into the corridors noticed that some members were filtering back into the chamber. Somebody was trying to testify that she then went to the speaker so as to inform her of the discussions of the meeting of the chief whips forum, and the speaker then informed her that the House would be reconvened and adjourned for the day. Mr. Kakude testified that nobody in that meeting on the afternoon of 21 August 25 under the B16 had suggested that the police be called into the chamber, or indeed that the person gathered there made a decision that the police be called into the chamber. Mr. Kakude referred to the event as embarrassing. Mr. Kakude said that this is probably the first time that this was happening in Parliament. Those aspects of Ms. Kakude's testimony were echoed by the testimony of Mr. Stimhason, the chief whip of the majority party, and I'll return to, get to Mr. Stimhason's evidence shortly. Ms. Kakude testified that whilst the meeting in the chief whip's boardroom had decided that the members of Parliament, the members of the House, would be asked to leave the immediate vicinity, that meeting could not make binding decisions. And it was ultimately the decision of the Speaker. Ms. Kakude gave that evidence also in answer to a question or a proposition where she was asked how she reconciles the discussion and outcomes of the meeting in the chief whip's boardroom and a subsequent apparent decision taken by the Speaker to reconvene the House and adjourn for the day. Following Ms. Kakude, evidence was then given by the chief whip of the opposition, Mr. John Stimhason. Mr. Stimhason confirmed that he was in the chamber. Mr. Stimhason confirmed that a meeting did take place in the chief court's boardroom. Mr. Stimhason confirmed that members were, to use his phrase, excited, concerned as to what was happening. Mr. Stimhason said that in his assessment there was very little coherence, very little structure, that he did not think that the parliamentary security and other staff were prepared to deal with events that had transpired in the chamber. Mr. Stimhason said that he left the meeting of the chief of the boardroom under the impression that we had made a decision that in order to allow the security services to perform their function, they want members of parties to retreat from the building. The reason given for this, for that, was that if there was to be any activity that took place around the security services dealing with it, they didn't want members in the way. school members filtering back into the chamber. He re-entered the chamber. He spoke with, amongst others, the leader of the opposition, the Honorable Musi Maimane. He was approached on at least two occasions, and this was depicted in the video footage, by the Honorable Jackson and Tembu. And Mr. Skenhaven said that he asked the Honorable Jackson and Tembu, what's happening now? Because this is not what we believe. And Mr. Skenhaven went on to say that the Honorable Tembu informed him that there'd been a change in plan. And that what would happen now is the House would be to leave and then adjourn. Mr. Skenhaven also said that the leader of the opposition, Mr. Maimane, was proposed to any forcible removal of the members of the EFF by security services. Mr. Stiernation confirmed that as far as he was aware, there was not at any time a forcible removal of the members of the EFF. Mr. Stiernation's testimony included that it was a very difficult situation. There was confusion. There was no coordination or structure. Mr. Stiernation said that he thought that Parliament was going forward and Parliament's officials would probably be better prepared. Mr. Stiernation specifically said, I don't think it's anything we were prepared for. Mr. Stiernation's evidence included that the rules of Parliament were broken. Mr. Stiernation said there was a genuine acceptance, and this is in relation to the conduct of the members who face charges of contempt, Mr. Chairman, before you and your committee. The Hansard of Mr. Stiernation's evidence includes the following. There was a genuine acceptance that the rules of Parliament were broken. And it is important that we respect and uphold the rules of Parliament. Otherwise, we end up with a situation where there are unbridled interactions, which is not what the Parliament is all about. Mr. Stiernation then went on to make a number of recommendations as to how he thought the matter could be dealt with differently. Indeed, Mr. Chairman, that deals with the evidence of the witnesses other than Mr. Castle. I would urge, Mr. Chairman, that you and the members of your committee accept the evidence of those witnesses for what that evidence means. There is no reason to suggest that the witnesses have withheld anything, have sought to manipulate evidence. The transcript reveals a thorough engagement also deal, Mr. Chairman, with the evidence of Mr. Carson at some length, starting at paragraph 102 of the submission and at page 67. Last time, I will deal with the charges not necessarily in chronological order, but rather in the order in which Mr. Castle gave his evidence. Whilst I am mindful of the concern as raised by the Honourable Sultani, and I accept 100% that it is the committee who will be deliberate and make a decision. The initiator's job is also not only the presentation of the evidence, but to suggest, to clarify, to guide as to whether or not that evidence tends to prove or disprove the charges of contempt as faced by the honourable members. That, however, cannot and does not substitute for the decision that the committee will be required to make subsequent to its deliberations. Charge one, Mr. Chairman and the members of your committee, is a charge, as you will note also from the map of the charges, that is faced by the Honourable Shivambu. It is a charge against the Honourable Ramakatsa, the Honourable Ezekiel Chabalala, Honourable Gardi, and the Honourable Ndlozi. That charge, as it was recorded in the notice of hearing of the Honourable Shivambu, says that it is alleged that you are guilty of conduct constituting contempt of Parliament in terms of Section 13A of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act, in that as a member of Parliament and giving questions to the President in the National Assembly, you contravene Section 7A by improperly interfering with or impeding the exercise or performance by the National Assembly of its authority or functions when you refuse to obey the instruction of the Speaker as you take your seat. This conduct impeded the House from performing its function of exercising oversight of the executive by posing questions to the President and continuing with his business for that day. Mr. Castle gave some evidence at length in relation to charge one. Mr. Castle made it clear that he is giving evidence in his capacity as the Secretary to the National Assembly. That he assists, guides, and is of service to all members and parties represented in the House, and that he in fact does so in the day-to-day performance of his duty. Mr. Castle confirmed that he was present in the House on 21 August 2014. In relation to charge one, I don't propose to take you through the report paragraph by paragraph, but Mr. Carter, with reference to the Hansard and the video footage, gave detailed evidence as to the speaker requiring that the affected honourable members, and I've read their names, take their seat. The affected honourable members refused. That much is not in dispute. The parcel referred to that part of the footage and indeed the Hansard where the speaker had explained the rules in relation to questions and supplementary questions on at least two that concern by the evidence that serves before this committee itself. The high watermark of that is the evidence of the Hansard in relation to the Honourable Shivambu in referring to another Honourable member who held in her hand, I think it is the Green Book, being the rules of the National Assembly. The Honourable Shivambu, early in the session, is recorded in the Hansard as saying the following: really, we have dealt with the issue of the rules. We have got that book as well. We know those things. Could that lady please sit down? I think it cannot any longer be any serious suggestion as to knowledge of the rules. Mr. Castle also made clear how the rules are distributed, both in hard copy and indeed their availability in digital or electronic format. Mr. Castle gave evidence as to the onboarding session that takes place, and indeed the assistance offered by members of the trade. The speaker herself, of course, in relation to questions and supplementary questions, had on two occasions explained the process. Having watched the video, Mr. Castle, and having read the relevant parts of the Hansard, Mr. Castle points out that the speaker had on a number of occasions said to the affected honourable members, take your seat. I'm not recognising. Take your seat. To another honourable member, the speaker, who purportedly arose on a point of order, the speaker says, that is not a point of order. Take your seat. The factual evidence in support of Charge 1 has been read extensively before the committee. That factual evidence is rather straightforward. That factual evidence, Mr. Chairman, establishes that the affected honourable members heard the speaker directing that they take their seat, and that the affected honourable members chose not to abide the speaker's direction. When viewed as assessed in its totality, the conduct of the affected members being Mr. Shivambu, Mr. Ramakatsan, Mr. Vishu, Chavalala, Mr. Dargi, Mr. Ngozi, and Mr. Malema, their conduct is indeed conduct that would fall within the charge of contempt as detailed in Charge 1. The facts are what they are. The facts must be given their ordinary assessment. I would urge Mr. Chairman that that ordinary assessment establishes that there was indeed a breach of the rules of Parliament on that day and as contemplated in Charge 1. We then get to Charge 2, and Charge 2 is in the following terms. It is alleged that you observe your conduct constituting contempt of Parliament, in that as a member of Parliament, and during questions to the President, you willfully refused and failed to obey Rule 51, read together with the rules of the National Assembly, in that you failed to withdraw immediately from the day's sitting when you were ordered to do so. This charge is a charge of contempt that has been brought against the Honourable Shivambu, the Honourable Ramakatsa, the Honourable Hichkio Chabalala, the Honourable Gardi, the Honourable Ndlozi, and the Honourable Malema. Again, the evidence that including page 90 at the top. Page 90 at the top, which pages 80 up to and including page 90 at the top of the principal submissions. Mr. Castle refers to Rule 51. If the presiding officer is of the opinion that a member is deliberately contravening a provision of the rules, or that a member is in contempt or disregarding the authority of the chair, or that a member's conduct is grossly disorderly, he or she may order the member to withdraw immediately from the chamber for the remainder of the day's sitting. Mr. Carso referred to various parts of the Hansard of the day. I reproduced those parts at paragraph 148 at page 81 of the principal submissions, and again pages 81, 82, and 83. Over those pages of the answer, there is an engagement between the main honourable members and the speaker. Those persons are identified. Those persons of engaging with the speaker, those persons are acting in a manner contrary to section 13A of the Act, 13C, my apologies, and rules 51 and rule 53.1. The evidence in support of this charge is rather uncontroversial. Mr. Castle also gave evidence as to the circumstances in which the speaker could take a step such as requiring or ordering an honourable member to leave the House or withdraw from the House immediately. Mr. Carter gave evidence that if the speaker was of the opinion that a member was deliberately contravening a provision of the rules, or that a member is in contempt or disregarding the authority of the chair, or that a member's conduct is grossly disorderly, he or she may order the withdrawal. Mr. Carter gave detailed evidence as to the rules and how they would operate and in this case apply. That evidence was clarified by a lengthy engagement of members of the committee with Mr. Carter. Mr. Chairman, there are submissions in relation to this charge, and those are at paragraph 8, my apologies, page 88 of the report, starting with paragraph 163 up to and including paragraph 167. Mr. Chairman and the members of your committee will be relieved to hear that I am some midway through this part, already at page 188 of a 175 page report. Mr. Chairman, I respectfully submit that the relevant facts have been established. Rule 51 and Rule 53.1 have been explained. Their application in these circumstances has been clarified. The evidence that serves before the committee, I would urge, and it's a matter ultimately for the committee to deliberate upon, does establish that the members acted in contravention of section 13C of the Act, and indeed a combination of rules 51 and rule 53. I now wish to turn to charge 3. Charge 3 is in the following terms. It is alleged that you are guilty of conduct constituting contempt of Parliament in terms of section 13A of the Act, and that as a member of Parliament and during questions to the President in the National Assembly on 21 August 2014, you contravene section 7B of the Act by improperly interfering with the performance of a member of his or her functions as a member in the following manner. When the Speaker might have wished to ask the president further questions from asking their questions, thereby preventing them from performing one of their functions as a member of FAR. This is a charge of contempt brought out against the Honourable Shivambu, the Honourable Ramakasa, the Honourable Richfield Chabalala, those three members. You will see this, Mr. Chairman, from the map of charges and under the heading Charge 3. Mr. Carson and in some detail have explained that the speaker had explained to the House both at the commencement of the session and early on in relation to the supplementary question arising out of question 2 of the order paper. The speaker explained the process of the main question and the supplementary questions that follow thereafter. The Hansard reveals that the speaker, on a number of occasions, attempts to recognize, or rather does recognize, the Honorable Holamisa as being the next person in the queue to ask a supplementary question. That much is clear from the Hansard. It is heard on the video footage. There can be little suggestion that the affected honourable members who face this charge of contempt, Mr. Shivambu, Mr. Ramakasa, and Ms. Rachel Chabalala, did not hear the speaker recognising Mr. Holomisa. Mr. Holomisa himself in a wonderful South African turn of phrase from the Eastern Cape expresses frustration, disdain I would say, where we hear him speak and notwithstanding the fact that we hear him speak, Ms. Litchfield Chabalala rises. At that moment in the video footage, we hear Mr. Holomisa say, "Hi, Bob." It's clear to all what took place. It was Mr. Holomisa's turn to speak. The speaker herself had said so on a number of occasions. I have reproduced the relevant part of the Hansard in the principal submissions, and this can be found at paragraph 174, starting at page 92, and running over the page onto page 93. On a number of occasions, the speaker specifically sought to recognize Mr. Holomisa as being the next member. The conduct of the named members who face this charge of contempt did indeed, in my submission, in my respectful submission, prevent Mr. Holomisa from speaking. I would urge respectfully that the honourable members knew and understood that Mr. Holomisa was the next person to speak. Again, these facts are rather uncontroversial. Those are the facts that serve as evidence before you and the members of your committee. I now, Mr. Chairman, wish to turn to charge 6. Charge 6 reads as follows. It is alleged that you are guilty of conduct constituting contempt of Parliament in terms of Section 13A of the Act, in that as a member of Parliament and during questions to the President in the National Assembly on 21 August 2014, you contravene Section 7C of the Act by creating or taking part in a disturbance within the precincts of Parliament while the House was meeting by inter alia shouting and or banging on tables and or refusing to obey the Speaker's instructions, and generally conducting yourself in a grossly disorderly manner, thereby interfering with or disrupting the proceedings of the House, forcing the Speaker to suspend proceedings temporarily, and ultimately adjourning the sitting for the day. This part of the submissions deals with the affected honourable members in two groups, I suppose. The group which last time round I referred to as Group A, and another group which I refer to as Group B. Group A would include the Honourable Shivambu, Ramakasa, Lethio Chabalala, Gardi, Ndlozi, and the Honourable Malema. Group B, and also in relation to charge 6, and I'm now referring to the map of charges over the page, would be made up of the Honourable Lowe, Mashabela, Matiase, Maxson, Munsami, and Nkama. I see there's a spelling error there. I will correct that later. Mr. Carter gave evidence at some length as to discharge. In the report, it is dealt with starting at page 96. Starting at page 96. Mr. Carter also referred to Rule 56 of the Rules of the National Assembly under the heading Grave Disorder. In the event of grave disorder at a meeting, the presiding officer may adjourn the meeting or may suspend proceedings for a period to be stated by him or her. The submissions, or rather the evidence and the submissions in relation to this charge, continue until page 106 at the top, until page 106 at the top. Mr. Castle, in his evidence and in relation to various parts of the video footage, Mr. Chairman, there was a to-ing and fro-ing, and Mr. Jonas was very patient with me as we tried to find the various spots in the video clip with some detail. Minute so-and-so, second so-and-so, lights were dimmed, the lights were undimmed, and I thank Mr. Jonas and the members of the committee for their patience. But it is important from Mr. Castle's perspective also that the members who face this charge, groups A and B as I have called them, be identified properly and carefully. I would submit that Mr. Castle did indeed do so. Mr. Castle also subsequently used a pointer. The events at the House, or in the Chamber, in relation to the charge of creating or taking part in a disturbance, are again rather straightforward. Those events have been described as unprecedented by one witness. Those events have been described by another witness as never having been seen before. Those events have been described as a breaking of the rules, and the rules must be respected. Mr. Carter asked, I suppose, to reflect or to think about other occasions where it was suggested to him there were similar circumstances. I think the turn of phrase was outbursts of song and the chanting of slogans. Mr. Carter, in giving his evidence to the chairman, did distinguish that kind of activity from that which took place in the Chamber on 21 August 2014. Respectfully submitted that an appropriate way to describe the conduct is that we see in the video footage a number of members, including the named members who faced this charge, 6, rising one after the other and in quick succession. The activity goes up to a crescendo, which involves a number of members on their feet, shouting, gesticulating, banging on tables, some with pens, others with hands, and others with the makara.